This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. This week, we're going back in time, and we're going to be talking about Jurassic World. We're also going to be talking about a couple smaller films, because Jurassic World's the only big one that's opening. That's on everyone's mind. But I like to cover all types of films. We'll go through a couple smaller ones, including Sunshine Superman, La Spienza, which I'm sure I butchered the pronunciation of that, When Marnie Was There, and How to Save Us. These are some smaller and actually some foreign films worth talking about this week. Oh, well, don't worry. There's going to be plenty of dinosaurs in this discussion. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, the box office predictions, and of course, the world famous DVD roundup. But before we get into that, this is how you can get a hold of me. You can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. Fat Guys at the Movies also works on my Instagram if you want to see some of the stupid things I post, because everybody's concerned about what I think. There's also Twitter. You can find me on twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
That's right, Ron Burgundy. Let's leap into the news. And the first piece is something somewhat sad. I mean, we got to say rest in peace to the classic horror film actor, Christopher Lee, who has had an amazing career. This guy was working almost to the bitter end. I mean, this guy was literally working two lifetimes in films into his 90s. And what's amazing is this man was cast in The Lord of the Rings back right after the turn of the century. And he was also cast as Count Dooku in Star Wars. And I remember both those movies because they kind of overlap those series in the films that he was appearing in. And I remember thinking, gosh, he's old then. I mean, Star Wars Episode 3 came out 10 years ago. And he was old then. So this guy is a legend and had been working for so much. But even before those, for horror movie fans, I mean, this guy had an illustrious career. He was in The Wicker Man. He was Count Dracula in the Hammer horror films, paired up with Peter Cushing. I mean, these guys were the new Bela Lugosi and Lon Chaney Jr. and Boris Karloff of the late 50s and into the 60s through Hammer horror. So Christopher Lee, it's sad to see him go, but boy, this guy had a good run. And there are some great films to watch in tribute to him. And I will always remember him, not just as Count Dooku and Saruman, but in The Wicker Man and Scaramanga and The Man with Golden Gun. I mean, this guy had a lot of stuff. So you will be missed, Christopher Lee. The next piece of news I want to talk about falls into the stupid category. And this is about, again, internet entertainment journalism eating its own. And it's spilling over into social media and the reality that people in social media don't actually understand what social media does. There was an article that came out this week. I'm not going to say the publication or the name of the author because all that does is draw more attention to it. It's the Streisand effect. But it was a story about Goodfellas, and it essentially said, this is why women can't understand Goodfellas. And immediately I saw all these colleagues posting it and linking to the article and saying, this guy's an idiot. This guy's stupid. Hey, what do you have to say about this? Calling these other well-known internet feminist journalists about, what do you think about this? And I'm like, guys, all you're doing is giving this author and the publication all the hits that they want. More people saw this article and read this article, thus giving the publication advertising dollars and traffic, and thus making the writer a genius within his own circle in that publication because he got people to share it on social media. And before you know it, it's trending. Look, if somebody writes something that you disagree with and you don't want to give it any attention and you want to show how dumb it is, don't talk about it. Because, first of all, it's just a stupid opinion piece. And then everyone had to write think pieces about it. I'm so sick and tired of think pieces. We've had this with Jurassic Park all week. We've had Jurassic Park think pieces. And it's fine to do a retrospective and to kind of look at Jurassic Park and the history of it. But to suddenly analyze cloning and DNA and finding some sort of way to spin some sort of social issue or gender politics into it, which is a big thing now because everyone wants... This guy, the guy who wrote this Goodfellow piece was so smart in saying, you know what? I'm going to write something that's really going to offend everybody. Outrage culture is going to take over. They're going to share it through social media and it's going to give me all this attention and it's going to be the most hit piece on our site. And guess what? I'm now going to be the king of that site. And you're going to see more from this guy. It's the Armand White effect. Armand White was a reviewer. He's still a reviewer, but he was on Rotten Tomatoes and he was known as a contrarian. He would love Jack and Jill, but he'd hate something that like everyone loved, like, you know, like the Avengers or something like that. He's playing the game and you just played right into it. So you know, people just stop being stupid. A couple other real quick pieces of news that I wanted to hit on. Chris Hemsworth has been cast in the all-female Ghostbusters, which is a silly thing to say anyways, because if it's an all-female movie. But he was cast as the receptionist, the Annie Potts character from the original Ghostbusters. And it's kind of good that it got that that buzz for it, because it's good for the film, because all these eyes went to that story. But it also shows that it's kind of bad, because it's just a teeny tiny little bit part, and this has gotten more attention than anybody else who's been cast in the movie, mainly the four female Ghostbusters that are in this film. Seriously, Chris Hemsworth and Paul Feig, the director, the guys involved in this movie, have gotten far more attention than the actual cast of all female Ghostbusters. Another little piece of news, Tomorrowland, sadly, which we know was kind of a flop, and it was only a flop because it cost so much. I mean, it's doing fine, but it just wasn't massive numbers. They're looking at it taking about $140 million loss. And people are like, oh, Disney, that's the problem for Disney. Well, slow down a bit. Because Avengers and Star Wars. I mean, you still got Avengers on the slate, and it's doing very, very well. And you've got Star Wars coming out at the end of the year. This is going to be a banner year for Disney. This reminds me of back in 2012 when John Carter of Mars came out, and everyone's like, oh, John Carter of Mars, such a bomb. And then Avengers came out and made all the money in the world. So we need to have a little bit of perspective when we talk about whether or not Disney's losing money. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Two movies that are coming out this fall I want to highlight. The first one stars Matt Damon.
Matt Damon.
Matt Damon is a man stranded on Mars in The Martian.
I'm entering this log for the record. This is Mark Watney. And I'm still alive. Obviously. I have no way to contact NASA or my crewmates, but even if I could, it would take 4 years for another manned mission to reach me.
Houston, be advised. We've got a video message.
Mark Watney is still alive.
Woo! In your face, Neil Armstrong.
This opens on October 2nd, and it's opening a little early. Now, Gravity opened on the same weekend, so kind of maybe they're trying to use that opening window to possibly get some award buzz, but maybe they're just going for popularity at this point. I mean, Gravity, I think, soared beyond its expectations just because it was such a great movie. My problem with this one, as much as I love Ridley Scott, he seems just really sarcastic in this movie. And I don't like him in this trailer, and you don't get all of it in the little clip I played. But I'm like, I don't know if I want to spend 2.5 hours on screen with this guy. This looks like it's going to be Matt Damon's little scene from Interstellar expanded to a whole movie, which... I don't know if I want to see that. The next one I want to talk about is, there's a little, I don't know if you've heard of this series. It's called The Hunger Games. This last one's coming out this year. Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 2 opens on November 20th.
Snow has to pay for what he's done.
One way or another, this war is going to come to an end.
We all have one enemy. He turns the best of us against each other. To the Capitol.
I'll say what I said last year when Mockingjay Part 1 came out. That would have been a great first part of a movie. I see the trailer to this and I'm like, you know what? This looks like half a movie. Even the trailer makes it look like half a movie. We're getting a rehash of some of the stuff we saw in the first film. Speeches being made from Katniss and a rebellion that's kind of halfway in swing. It just even from the trailer, this doesn't seem complete. This just feels like it's going to be the ending of a movie. You know, it's still going to do big because it's Hunger Games. I hate the idea of cutting something in half arbitrarily just to make money. Nothing against making money. But this doesn't serve any sort of story or context whatsoever. And I'm hoping that it's going to be ground into the dirt with the Divergent final movies when they come out in the next 2 years. All right, that's it. I got to go to break. When I come back, I'm going to take you to prehistoric times with Jurassic World. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's go back in time. Let's get in our time machine. We're going to go back. Actually, we're only going to go back 22 years. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Jurassic Park movies first, because Jurassic World, part of a kind of an unremembered franchise. Everyone knows there's multiple movies to Jurassic Park, but when you say Jurassic Park, people think of the first movie. It's like Jaws. You think of the first Jaws, and all the sequels are kind of superfluous. And while everyone remembers Jaws 2 and 3 and maybe The Revenge, those are more sort of like dumped onto the marketplace. People remember Jurassic Park, and Jurassic World is trying to recapture that magic that Jurassic Park had. And the original Jurassic Park came out in 1993. That's 22 years ago. People forget how jaw-dropping and crap-your-pants amazing the effects were back then. It was the first time you really saw fully realized full CGI creatures. I mean, they'd had CGI before, and of course, obviously, they had Terminator 2 with the CGI Terminator, the liquid metal Terminator. This was the first time you had full-blown, fully articulated, real-type creatures, and it was amazing. And the reason they did that is they were originally going to do it all animatronic. And they had Stan Winston in there to do that. And Dennis Muren came in and was like, hey, I can do this on the computer. And he showed this skeletal structure of a T-Rex, I think, walking. And Spielberg's like, we're developing this because this is the future. And they did this mix of CGI and animatronic. I mean, they used for some shots CGI, some shots animatronic. And it still holds up for the most part. I mean, there's some artifacting. There's a lot of artifacting. If you actually go back and watch Jurassic Park, the original, a trained eye is going to look at that and say, yeah, these look somewhat rudimentary, but they still look really good. I mean, they look passable for today's effects, but if they released Jurassic Park, the first one now, people would say, well, that didn't quite look real. But one of the things people don't know is they didn't start mixing CGI and animatronic elements until the third movie, which was still 14 years ago. That was Jurassic Park 3. And then that was the first time you actually saw in the same shot an animatronic Velociraptor and a CGI Velociraptor. But right now there's this big debate that's been spurred on because of Jurassic World in particular and the whole thing, which we hear all the time, ooh, CGI looks crappy. Well, we know it's not a dinosaur. We know that it's in a pixels in a computer. When you know it's fake, you're going to see it as fake. Only when it's pioneering effects do people really, really notice. Because I remember watching Jurassic World just a couple days ago and saying, the effects still look really good. They're CGI. Yeah. Why? Because we don't have real dinosaurs. And I was trying to tell, I mean, I kind of got wrapped up in the story, but I was trying to see if I could see any animatronics. And I think there were some, I think there may have been some models that they then layered CGI on, which they couldn't do back in 93 when they did the first movie. There's a scene where the raptors have their heads in sort of these muzzles. And I think they probably put real head shells in there and then like animated the eyes and the lips and to give it a little more realistic appearance. The biggest problem with CG is if it's sometimes over animated, but if you know it's not real, you just know it's not real. And so you're not going to be believed. And so the cynicism of people's own heart gets in their way. And then they say, well, that just looks bad. The reality is CGI still looks pretty good. If they had done Jurassic World with animatronics, it would have looked ridiculous. But I can go back and watch the original Jurassic Park and the other movies, The Lost World and Jurassic Park 3, and I'll look at it and I'll be like, I can tell when it's a CGI T-Rex versus an animatronic T-Rex, and I can look at the T-Rex that's a model and know that it's a model. I went down to Kings Island this week before I went to see Jurassic World with my kids. They had this Walk with Dinosaur exhibits that we went to because we got these season passes that allow us in there, and they're articulated dinosaurs. But you can tell they're rubber and plastic, and even if though they look really good, they don't have the organic movement. You will never get the fully organic movement with just simple animatronics. You got puppetry that can be involved, but by that point, might as well just do some CGI, because the CGI can do the fine work. That's just a little bit of a defending of CGI, because people are out there going seeing Jurassic World and saying, oh, that's just, it doesn't look right. It's just a bunch of crap CGI. They're dinosaurs, man. You know velociraptors don't exist. And you know what? You go back and watch any of the other Jurassic Park movies, you know velociraptors don't exist. Not in today's world. And in fact, they never exist looking the way they do. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's get into the review of Jurassic World. More than 20 years after the disaster at Jurassic Park, a theme resort is finally opened with many species of dinosaurs, including a ruthless, genetically enhanced creature in a family atmosphere. What could possibly go wrong?
Every time we've unveiled a new attraction, attendance has spiked.
That was awesome.
Corporate felt genetic modification would up the wow factor.
They're dinosaurs, wow enough.
She was designed to be bigger than the T-Rex.
What happened to the sibling?
She ate it. We have an asset out of containment.
I remember 22 years ago when I saw Jurassic Park. It was the summer between my junior and senior year in college, and I was just enthralled with it. I was a kid again, just loving dinosaurs and wanting everything to do with dinosaurs. This is the closest I've gotten to capturing that excitement, and this is really the first movie I got really excited about. I was dubious of Tomorrowland, and as much as I liked Tomorrowland, I was leading up to it, I was a little nervous about it, and I was very excited for the Avengers, and I was a little let down by that one. Jurassic World, it lived up to my expectations. I was not expecting the first one. If you go in expecting the very first Jurassic Park movie, if you go in expecting Spielberg's version of the film, you're not going to get it. It reminds me a lot of Jurassic Park 3. Jurassic Park 3 was a much more simple movie of just a couple people stuck on an island, dinosaurs trying to eat them. This one has much bigger scope. Like you said, it's not the first one. But the gee whiz factor's gone, and they actually play to that. In fact, when they have the big trumpeting Jurassic Park theme, it's not seeing the dinosaurs that has the exciting theme. It's seeing the hotel and the visitor center and all the cool stuff that you'd get when you walk into an amusement park. You walk into Disney World, you walk into Kings Island, you walk into Knott's Berry Farm. You don't get excited on the roller coaster. You get excited walking in because you're seeing everything at first, and it's so exciting because you're on Main Street or you're on International Street, and you're just like, wow, that looks so cool. That's sort of the awe that's given to this movie. And I think it's kind of a tip of the hat to the fact of being aware. The movie's kind of self-aware that way. And I think that's kind of cool. Now, it doesn't contemplate genetic engineering, and it doesn't contemplate whether or not we should be cloning things. And it doesn't even contemplate whether this science is even remotely possible. Because you know what? It's not. It's never going to happen. DNA does not last that long. It lasts a couple thousand years. And that's it. It just breaks down. But even in the movie, there's a little conversation they have with the scientist and the owner. And they basically say, look, these aren't real creatures. We kind of made them already. I mean, we made them to what you wanted them to be. And I there was somebody I knew on Twitter who was saying that he didn't want to see it because he's like, well, dinosaurs had feathers. And that's true. A lot of dinosaurs did have feathers. Well, they took them off. That's sort of the explanation, is this is all manufactured anyways, because it's a complete bunk science. It kind of works. It's acceptable, but it's total nonsense. This is an action movie. And yeah, there's violence. And yeah, innocent people get killed and attacked. And it can be disturbing at times. But you know, it's cartoony because it's a dinosaur. It's not cartoony because you don't have somebody coming in and like mowing people down in a classroom or a movie theater. That's real things that have happened. You do not have a flock of pterodons attacking people on Main Street in Disney World. That has never happened and will never happen. But it's PG-13. It's scary. It can be pretty terrifying for little kids. But it's a lot of fun. And Bryce Dallas Howard is good in it. Chris Pratt's good in it. I'd like to see them do a remake of Romancing the Stone because I think they got a great chemistry there. But anyways, Jurassic World was a lot of fun. I'm probably going to see it again. It's one of the few movies I want to see again as a big summer blockbuster. And it kind of recharged me for this summer in terms of the big tentpole releases. So I got to say Jurassic World rocked.
It rocks. Excellent.
That's it for this run. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about some smaller movies, including Sunshine Superman, When Marnie Was There, and La Sapienza. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr coming out of the segment of gee whiz special effects and tentpole releases and rolling into some more, let's say, for lack of a better term, let me come up with a term that's somewhat respectful. Artsy-fartsy, probably the way you say it. These are the artsy-fartsy movies. This is our artsy-fartsy segment. I'm going to be talking about a couple films that I've seen this week. One of them's a documentary. Two of them are foreign films. And they're worth mentioning kind of in the middle of all of this Jurassic World and all the dinosaurs running around and eating people and stomping on people's faces. Let's talk about some more smaller releases. The first one is Sunshine Superman. The life of base jumper founder Carl Banish is examined.
There are many man-made laws that need to be broken.
We started talking about Carl's grand idea, fixed object jumping.
Buildings, antenna towers, spans, and earth.
It evolved into the word base.
Go! We were pioneers.
He is nuts.
I don't know what I've gotten myself into. It's what skydivers call a rush.
He assigned a lot more importance to the laws of nature than he did the laws of man.
Many people have heard the term base jumping. And in my ignorance, I always thought it was just somebody jumping off the base of something like, you know, like a cliff. It's a base and they jump off the base and they fly to the bottom, parachute, or they jump off a building, which is a kind of a base. And that's what I always thought it meant. But really, they talk about what BASE stands for: bridges, antenna towers, spans, and earth, rocks and cliffs. And this is a film about Banish and how he sort of developed base jumping. It was in its infancy with him. And that's really kind of extreme sports in general. Extreme sports have really developed over the last 50 to 70 years. I mean, if you go all the way back to surfing, for example, I actually watched this other documentary this week. I mean, it's not worth covering because you can't see it anywhere. It had a one-shot run last week, like on Wednesday, and it had one night in theater, so I had no way to cover it, called The Search for Freedom. And that kind of gives a history of extreme sports, where it develops from surfing to skiing to extreme skiing and snowboarding, windsurfing. And then, of course, they also talk about base jumping there and gliding down with like wingsuits. Extreme sports sort of mesh with technology, because as technology's gotten better, not just with cameras that people can strap on their heads and watch, because they used to do it with 16mm cameras like you saw in Sunshine Superman, but just the materials that they use. The wing suits, you couldn't have made those wing suits back in the 70s, but you see wing suits every now and then. I think you can see them in the Point Break trailer. They're in the third Transformers film, Dark of the Moon, I think. You've seen these in movies before, and even if you're not terribly familiar with it, and extreme sports and sort of the X Games type of mentality has evolved and is continuing to evolve, and people are pushing the limits farther and farther and farther, and it's very dangerous. The Search for Freedom, that's an interesting movie in itself. It's beautifully shot, but it's really more of just a profile, so it doesn't actually take you through a narrative, so it's not the strongest movie, but it looks really cool. Sunshine Superman tells the story of Banish and how he developed base jumping, and how people just, they'd go to Yosemite and they'd sneak all their equipment in and they'd get up like onto the top of El Cap and then they'd quickly get it going and then jump off. And whether the legalities of these things and then suddenly getting some sponsors and getting people interested in it and getting more and more people interested in the sport, gaining legitimacy, going to those daredevil lengths. They have one scene in the movie where he was paid to jump off like the highest building in, I forget, like Memphis or something like that, and land during a parade. And it's an interesting film because for people in today's world, this is nothing new. People jumping off of buildings is, you know, we see that all the time, especially YouTube. In the age of YouTube, if you want to see people doing extreme sports, it's just literally a web search away. But back in the 70s and 80s, when Banish was developing this stuff, you had to get these, strap these 16 millimeter cameras to it. And then you had to get somebody to present the stuff, and you had to have it developed. You have it edited and put in music. And that was not always an easy task. So this movie shows how it developed to something that nowadays just anybody can find. And you got GoPro cameras that you can literally, the smallest piece of equipment you're going to have, they're like the size of a carabiner, and you can have them on your helmet. It's an interesting look at the sport, and it's an interesting look at his life and some of the tragic things that happened. So I'm going to say Sunshine Superman, especially for the historical context, I think kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's cover a couple foreign films. The first one I want to cover, because it's Studio Ghibli, and anyone who knows me knows I'm a huge fan of Studio Ghibli. They're, of course, the people who did movies like Spirited Away and My Neighbor Totoro. Most recently, they did The Tale of Princess Kaguya, and it's Hayao Miyazaki is sort of the king of Studio Ghibli. He's since retired. The Wind Rises was his final film, supposedly. But there's other directors who work in that field. Now, what establishes, what really makes Studio Ghibli films a Studio Ghibli film is they're Japanese, and they take place usually, have some sort of wilderness sense of wonder to this whole thing. And some of them are real high concept and out there, like the Nausicaa, which is basically almost like a Middle Earth type fairy tale. But other ones like The Wind Rises, which is about an aviator, about a guy who designs airplanes, but it still has that open fields and sweeping story and epic scope. And that's what you get with this film, When Marnie Was There. And this is a much smaller film, and it's about a girl who, I'm not going to play a trailer because it's in Japanese, and unless you speak Japanese, it's not going to make any sense. But it's about this girl who has some medical issues like asthma, and so she's sent from a city to the country to live. And there's this house down the road on the water, and she meets this girl, this blonde-haired girl there, and befriends her, and they have this friendship, but there's something different about this friendship, and she doesn't know quite what this girl's story is. The girl's name's Marnie, which is, of course, where When Marnie Was There. And again, like Studio Ghibli, it also has this sort of very fantastic element to it, and it's very beautiful, and it doesn't have a fantastic element than, say, some American movie like Home, the movie about the alien coming down that came out a couple months ago, or The Avengers, or even something like Inside Out, which comes out next week from Pixar, which is extremely high concept and very abstract. This one, the fantastic element is very subtle, very beautiful in the process, and it's gorgeously animated, but it's also not excessively animated. It's not just there to be bright colors and cool flash. It's there to enhance the little sweet little story. And while it's not as cool and warm and fuzzy as like My Neighbor Totoro, it still is interesting to check out. I got to say, if you like Studio Ghibli, this will not disappoint. It has all those elements that you expect. So When Marnie Was There, kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
The next one I want to talk about is, and I'm going to butcher the pronunciation because I don't speak Italian, is La Sapienza. And it's a French and Italian film. It's in French and Italian. And it's about this guy who's an architecture expert, and he's writing a book about this architect, and he and his wife traveled to Italy to look at the architecture, and they're having some issues with their relationship, and they run into this couple, well, a brother and sister pair, younger, you know, like in their early 20s or late teens, and they kind of pair off with them, and the guy goes off with the brother, and the woman goes off with the sister, and they kind of have these discussions, and sort of this age of discovery of learning more about the relationship and sort of on some eye-opening things that happen. This is extremely French. I was watching it as a screener, and I saw with my wife, my kids were there, and I'm like, this is a very French movie. It's got these long shots, these very deliberate, you know, very unnaturally placed, directly looking at the camera, some very awkward silences, which is there to just kind of throw it out there and to be somewhat off-putting and uncomfortable. I'm not a huge fan of French cinema, so it was a little bit lost on me. But I wasn't bored with it. I'll say that. I mean, at least had something going on, and it had a point. And while it was challenging you to say, oh, what do they really mean when they say this? I mean, it was there, and it wasn't completely obtuse. But it is very deliberately done, and almost to the point of it could be a parody of French cinema, which I almost took in that context. But I really don't think it was. I think it was just a little high on itself. But if you like that sort of thing, if you like French contemplation cinema with awkward pauses and sometimes very unrealistic performances and deliveries, very deliberate unrealistic performances and deliveries, and not a shred of humor except for one scene, you're going to get that with this one. I'm still going to have to say that La Sapienza kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
All right. I need to go to a break. When I come back, let's talk about a horror film, How to Save Us, the box office, and the world-famous DVD Roundup. Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Car coming back at you with Fat Guys at the Movies, wrapping things up. We got one more movie to talk about, and of course we're going to be talking about the box office and the DVD roundup. But first, let's jump into this movie. It's a horror film. It's a smaller horror film, but I've said before, even if you aren't a particular fan of a specific horror film, some of the most interesting thrillers and horror movies you're going to find will not be in the theaters. Yeah, you've got, if you like the mass market stuff like Insidious 3, which came out last week, and occasionally you can find some pretty innovative stuff like It Follows, which got a wide release. But generally, the more edgy and cooler and more different stuff you'll find is going to be on demand. And this is one of those films, you're going to have to seek it out if you want to see it. And it's called How to Save Us. A man walks across Tasmania in the wake of an outbreak apocalypse to find his brother.
The closer we can come to extinction if this is left unchecked.
The military says there's a virus and they're containing it. That is enough for me. I'm well. My family is well. I have no interest in digging up something that could cost me or any other fellow Australians their lives. I say this is the military's problem. Let the military handle it.
This is directed and written and stars the guy who did All Superheroes Must Die, which was a pretty fringe movie in itself, but was an interesting take on superheroes, and it was also very low budget, and I mean, it wasn't a Marvel movie at all, but it was sort of spinning off of the popularity of superhero movies, trying to give a more realistic, grim version of them than just the gee whiz, wham bang kind of action movie we get nowadays. I would say it's probably at about the same level, although it's a very different film. It's essentially a zombie movie without zombies in it. And it's, like I said, it's about this guy. He's walking the desert. He's trying to find his brother, and the outbreak turns people into these creatures that are sort of like these energy apparitions. So they're not zombies. They don't come and eat your flesh. But they're these energy apparitions, and to hide from them, you got to cover yourself in human ash, and you can hear them on the radio, but you also don't want to use too many electronics because that attracts them. And I'd say the first half of the movie is just this guy kind of walking the earth. And it's meant to give atmosphere. And it doesn't quite do that as effectively as it could. Mainly because it stars the director and writer, and he's not terribly compelling on screen. That's the triple threat. The reason it's called a triple threat is that only a few people can do it. You know, somebody like Mel Gibson was a triple threat. He could write, direct, and act. And like Woody Allen in comedies and Mel Brooks in comedies could do that. That is not easy to do, and not a whole lot of people can. So this guy really can't? I mean, he would have been better served having a different actor because he's just not compelling on screen. But I'll tell you, about halfway through the movie, it does get some interesting ideas in there. But by the time it gets to some interesting idea of what these creatures are and how they affect humanity and what the connection is and what the link is and what happened to everybody even. I mean, there's some neat stuff that happens, but by the time I got to it, I was just so tired of the guy walking the earth. It just got boring for me. And so it was just a lot too late. You know how a lot of times people say too little, too late? This one was plenty of stuff, but it was just too late. I mean, it wasn't too little, but it just all came so late. I was just, I mean, it like takes like 45 minutes to an hour to get to the cool stuff and to get to the really interesting elements of the film. But knowing that going in, don't watch it late at night, you know, when you're falling asleep and you just want to get it over with. Take your time. It's short. It's like 70 minutes, 80 minutes long. So, but I'm still going to have to say How to Save Us kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Last week, who won? Well, the winner, I said the winner was going to be Spy with $55 million. I was correct with it being Spy. I was way off with the number, sadly, because I would have expected there to be a lot more money coming at Melissa McCarthy. There's been a lot of discussion as to why this didn't do so well. And some people like to blame the marketing. I honestly think what caused this film to suffer was the fact that Melissa McCarthy has just done the one-note comedy up to this. And yeah, The Heat did well, but then you had like Identity Thief and you had Tammy, which Tammy was terrible last year. I think she kind of got people tired of her character. It's the Adam Sandler effect. Adam Sandler can do stupid enough, and then people finally just get tired of it. Michael Bay can do stupid movies, and then people start to get tired of it. You cannot be a one-note comedian and keep a wide audience. So I think what happened with this movie is people were just expecting it to be another Melissa McCarthy movie. I think they were expecting it to be Tammy with the CIA. And that's not what it is, but I think that that's why it suffered a bit at the box office. Not, it only made $29 million. It didn't even make $30 million, which is kind of sad. It still won the weekend. I mean, it beat San Andreas in its second round, but by only like $3 million or so. Insidious Chapter 3 did okay with $22.5 million. It was not a huge hit, but like I said, summertime's an odd time to release a movie like this. I know The Conjuring did extremely well, but generally summertime's not a horror movie release. Horror movies tend to do best in the off months, either October for like big ticket items or like January or September or even August for horror movies. So I think Insidious probably would have done better if it had a different release date. And then Entourage made $10 million. I knew it wasn't going to do terribly well because it burned off a lot of its demand earlier in the week. I mean, it made almost half of its entire $18 million take just in the first 2 days. And then Love and Mercy came in at number 11 with just over 2 million, which is that's not great for almost 500 theaters, especially considering the reviews it got. Now, this week, what's going to happen? I think Jurassic World is going to be a monster hit. It's not going to be as big as Avengers, certainly. It's not going to be as big as Furious 7. Those have a lot going into it. I mean, those had a lot of buildup in the last couple of years with previous films. It's been 14 years since the last Jurassic Park movie. But I still think this is going to be one of your 100 million plus weekends. Part of it is because there's nothing running against it, really. The biggest competition it has, I mean, you've got San Andreas that's out, but it's in its third week and it made 26 million last weekend. You got Mad Max, which is in its fourth week. And then you've got Avengers and that's it. So it's sort of like wide open for the tent pole. And it's the only one out there. There's nothing running against it, really. I mean, there's a couple smaller movies expanding, but that's it. And so it's kind of out there. It is bona fide summertime now. So whereas you had kids still going to school before Memorial Day, it's middle of June, wide open here. So I think this thing's going to be a monster hit. I mean, $115 million, I wouldn't be surprised if it was $120, $125, but I'm not going to put my money on that because I can. $115 million is what I say for Jurassic World. I just hope that it makes more than $100 million because I want it to make more than Transformers did last year. And everything, all the indications are there that it's tracking high, and it's tracking higher than anything for the summer of 2014. So it's going to be one of the biggest openings this summer. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous DVD Roundup. Topping the list is The Duff. This was a big surprise for me. I adored this movie. I thought it was really cute. Mae Whitman was adorable in this movie. I think she's a real talent, and she's cute, but she can also be very vulnerable and can play that secondary character. It was a big enough hit for, you know, sort of this modern teen movie. The Duff is really fun. Kingsman: The Secret Service is also out. I was sort of, I kind of blew hot and cold with this movie. It's written by Mark Millar, and I felt the same way about his stuff with the Kick-Ass series. His stuff is like halfway there for me. It gets a little bit too self-aware, and it gets a little bit too goofy, and it gets a little bit too silly, and it doesn't take itself seriously, and it breaks down, in my opinion. And I think that happens. There's one scene in Kingsman where, I mean, I know a lot of people love that scene because it's the one in the church, if you've seen it, and it, because it just becomes absurd. And yeah, that's fine, but they don't set the movie up that way to be that. And so when it goes off the rails, it's off the rails forever. It never recovers. And Kick-Ass, and especially Kick-Ass 2, kind of did that. So I'm not a wild fan of the writing of these, but it was decent enough for what it was. Teen Wolf, the MTV series, is in season 4, is now available on DVD. Another TV show is The Strain, season 1. I've not watched it. I've heard a lot of great things about it. This is Guillermo del Toro's spearheaded on effects about a sort of a vampire type strain of bacteria that comes from space. So then Serena, which is the other Bradley Cooper romance bomb from this year, and that's with Jennifer Lawrence, and they had some big movies together, so, you know, it's kind of embarrassing that this one was such a underwhelming film. But the stinker of the week is Project Almanac. Why? Found footage, time travel. If you want a better time travel movie, see Jurassic Park, because even though it doesn't involve time travel, it's far more realistic and far more easy to swallow than Project Almanac. And then that's it. Next week I'm going to be talking about the new Pixar movie Inside Out. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.